Let me set the scene on where the Russia-Ukraine situation stands this morning, because the geometry of this conflict has shifted in ways that matter. On Tuesday, Trump and Putin spoke for about an hour. When that call ended, the Kremlin's message to Washington was not ambiguous: stop all assistance to Ukraine, not reduce it, not discuss conditions, stop everything. That demand came after Trump reportedly pressed Putin for a swift conclusion to the war. And Putin essentially responded by presenting a maximalist position, which is what he does when he believes he's negotiating from strength.
What's striking to me is the sequencing here. Trump goes into that call trying to be the deal maker, and what he gets back is a precondition that he'd have to demolish American foreign policy to meet. Cutting all Ukraine aid isn't a negotiating position at this stage, it's a demand for capitulation before talks even begin. And the domestic politics of that are complicated for Trump, because even within his own party there are senators who have drawn lines on Ukraine support. The Senate is now a dead heat, as we'll get into, and he needs those senators in November.
Then there's the Zelensky plane incident, which Norway's prime minister confirmed. A suspected Shahed-type drone, the Iranian-designed loitering munitions Russia has been using in large quantities, came close to Zelensky's aircraft as it was departing Moldova, heading to Oslo for King Harald V's funeral. Let me underscore that. The Ukrainian president's plane nearly struck by a drone while en route to a state funeral for a NATO-adjacent head of state. That's not an accident of targeting. That's a signal.
And it arrives the same week NATO intelligence services foiled a Russian plot to physically sabotage undersea communications cables. We're talking about the fiber optic infrastructure that carries the vast majority of internet traffic, financial data, and military communications between Europe and North America. Russia has been probing these cables for years. There were incidents near Svalbard in the Baltic in the North Sea, but an active sabotage plot being interdicted is a different category. NATO allies don't usually publicize these interventions unless they want Russia to know the network is being watched.
That's exactly the point. The disclosure itself is a deterrence message. It says, "We caught this one, we're watching the others, and we're prepared to name you publicly." For Moscow, the calculus on undersea infrastructure has historically been that deniability gives them flexibility. Removing that deniability changes the equation. Now, threading this back to the Trump-Putin call, the Kremlin is running simultaneous tracks, demanding diplomatic concessions publicly while operationally continuing to probe and attack Western infrastructure. Those two things are not contradictions in Moscow's framework. They're parallel instruments of pressure.
Iran adds another layer to this pressure architecture. The IRGC has now formally laid out conditions for ending what they're calling their war with the United States, and the demands are significant. Halt strikes, release $24 billion in frozen assets, and stop interfering with Iran's nuclear program. Simultaneously, they've declared a new maritime zone, which is almost certainly connected to the disputed area around what Trump publicly referred to as Pickaxe Mountain, where he warned Iran, quote, not to get cute. That's not a phrase that appears in standard diplomatic cable traffic.
The maritime zone declaration is the part that's being underreported. When a state unilaterally declares a new maritime zone, they are asserting control over navigation, potentially including military vessels and commercial shipping. In the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz context, that's not a symbolic gesture. Roughly 20% of global oil supply transits that strait. If Iran enforces that zone, you get confrontations. If the US ignores it, Iran claims a propaganda victory. It's a trap designed to produce a response regardless of what Washington does.
And Kim Jong-un's public acknowledgement of North Korean troops fighting abroad lands right in the middle of all this. He praised them at North Korea's founding anniversary, September 9th, which is the highest profile possible moment for such a declaration. Pyongyang has previously maintained deniability about the deployment of Korean People's Army soldiers to support Russian operations. That deniability is now gone. Kim chose to remove it himself, which tells you he's decided the strategic benefit of publicizing the alliance with Russia outweighs any diplomatic cost with China or the broader international community.
The deeper implication is that we now have what amounts to a formalized military partnership between Russia and North Korea that is acknowledged by both parties, occurring simultaneously with Iranian weapons supply to Russia and Iranian confrontation with the United States. These aren't separate crises. They share a common interest in straining American capacity and credibility across multiple theaters at once. Whether that's coordinated in any formal sense is almost beside the point. The effect is the same.